Guess what's happening on this week's episode of the Beating Diabetes Lifestyle Podcast with your friend and host, Oscar Camejo.
We all know that what we eat affects our health. Unfortunately, despite having that knowledge, some people still struggle when it comes to making better food choices and living an overall healthy lifestyle. Now, why is that? To help me answer that question, joining me on this week's episode of the Beating Diabetes Lifestyle Podcast is my special guest, Jamie Pope. She's a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and licensed dietitian, nutritionist. She comes with a wealth of knowledge in the nutrition education space and so forth. Jamie is a co-author of Nutrition for a Changing World, second edition. You know, when I first began learning about nutrition to improve my own health, I stumbled across Jamie's work. And I will tell you this, I have learned so much about how the body works and how nutrition affects our bodies, even when it comes down to weight loss. In fact, some of the insight I share from time to time on this podcast actually comes from things that I've gleaned from learning from Jamie's research. So in today's episode, Jamie and I discuss what eating healthy really means in light of today's food choices. We even talk about carbs versus calories and what we should know. We also talk about the link between poor health and poor nutrition and why prioritizing nutrition is so critical, folks. And you know, we also talk about how better nutrition and certain lifestyle changes may help in reversing type 2 diabetes and other chronic illnesses. You know, folks, we cover so much practical information in this episode that, I mean, we went about an hour and a half, that's right, of discussing so much. Matter of fact, every time Jamie and I talk, we just go on and on about just things that are happening in society when it comes to nutrition, and we talk about better health. I mean, it's always a great conversation. So that's why I wanted to have her on the show. So if you want to watch the full episode on YouTube, be sure to check the show description on whatever platform you listen to this podcast so you can go ahead and watch the episode online. So for now, stick around to hear the rest of today's episode, giving your body what it needs for weight loss and better health with Jamie Pope. Let's go. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Beating Diabetes Lifestyle Podcast with me, your friend and host, Oscar Camejo. My goal is to help diabetics and non-diabetics make lifestyle changes to reverse and prevent type 2 diabetes. Joining me today is my favorite, my utmost favorite professor of all things nutrition. She literally wrote the book on nutrition. Let's welcome Miss Jamie Pope. Hey, Jamie.
Hi, Oscar. This is fun. Thank you for inviting me, for following me. I'm excited about this.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Now, folks, I've been telling you all that I was going to be having some high caliber folks for this season 2 of the podcast. And this podcast is reaching people in 35, at least 35 territories and countries. And to have Jamie on the show is a treat for me, and I know it's going to be a treat for you. So I want to share with you her background so you know the caliber of person that we have on the show today. Now, she's big time, so we are very humble and grateful to have Jamie on the show. So I'm going to read her bio. Now, she has a lot of experience in the field of education, nutrition education, weight management, and so forth. And Jamie will go into her story and tell you a little bit more about her. So she has a Master of Science, and she's a registered dietitian nutritionist. She's a licensed dietitian nutritionist. She's big time. And she's a fellow of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. She's going to explain some of that to us. But with all of this, being an assistant professor, of Nutritional Sciences in the Vanderbilt University School of Nursing. She has been with Vanderbilt since 1986, working in the area of obesity research, weight management, health promotion, that's big time, and heart disease prevention since 2000. She teaches introductory nutrition courses. Now, I need to pause there. Now, why this is so big and so important and such a blessing for me is because when I started going down the avenue of wanting to learn more about nutrition, even after I was able to reverse and send diabetes into remission, I still wanted to know about nutrition. What are things that I should be putting in my body and how can I help other people and so forth. So I stumbled onto Jamie and her on social media, found her on Amazon, on Audible, and I downloaded her Nutrition 101 book, and it's been such a blessing. So I'm going to go on and read this and we'll have Jamie to jump in. You know, based on her professional and scholarly contributions, she earned the status of fellow of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics in 2017. She serves on the Executive Leadership Committee of Nutrition Educators of Health Professionals Dietetic Practice Group. Now, Jamie also has also served as Corporate Nutrition Consultant, Media Representative, and Scientific Advisor for several companies and corporations. Hey, Jamie, that's a lot.
You've done a lot. Yeah. I've had a few decades to do it in. So it's been a good run. I love what I do.
Right. Awesome.
And I love the people I get to work with.
Yeah. And it comes out in what I've heard on your social media and even listening to your courses and so forth. And one of the reasons that really intrigued me about Jamie's story and just her passion for education is she's very practical, folks. I'm telling you, she's very practical. She's very knowledgeable. She likes to say she doesn't like to give her opinion. She gives you facts, very evidence-based. And I love that about her because, you know, with so many things that are being promoted these days in the health and nutrition space, it's good to know that you have somebody who's, you know, committed to just giving people practical information that they can actually use and build a lifestyle around health and nutrition. So thank you again, Jamie, for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So, Jamie, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you even start down this road of nutrition?
Well, pretty accidentally, actually. When I think back on what really prompted my interest in nutrition and just even considering nutrition was in high school, being assigned to do a survey. And you could pick anything you wanted. It was actually an English class. And I chose what people ate for lunch. You know, not that I really even cared that much then, but I had to do a survey. And I went to an all-girls school at the point, and we had no cafeteria that year. We were eating out of vending machines that had soups and sandwiches, but also had other items in these vending machines. And at the end of the survey, I found the two most commonly consumed foods at lunch were Cheetos and Milky Way bars. Wow. Doesn't mean people weren't eating other things, but those came up number one and two.
Right.
And in writing up the implications for that survey, I'd never really thought about balance. I never really thought about vitamins and minerals. I mean, it just kind of was what it was. I didn't really consider the implications of consuming those kind of foods as a core to your diet.
Right.
And then I remember soon afterwards sitting at the dinner table and my mom putting a plate in front of me that had, I think I still remember, like pork chops, mashed potatoes, succotash, a roll, and a little side, this is the 70s, a fruit cocktail, you know, right out of a can.
Right.
And looking down at that and having like literally this epiphany of, oh, that's why we eat meat and starch and vegetable and fruit and bread. You know, nobody thought about fiber or anything back then.
Right.
So that was kind of the beginning of actually noticing. Mm-hmm. And I think also you have to consider the 70s and, you know, at the time being female, I guess males right. too, but just weight conscious and, you know, people skipping lunch and efforts to control things. I mean, just all the crazy practices too, probably right. played into it. And then going to college and thinking I had to pick a major and okay. looking in the catalog and seeing a course on vitamins and thought, that looks pretty good.
Oh, wait, there was an entire course just on vitamins?
Yeah, it was within the nutrition curriculum. So, oh, wow. Oh yeah, vitamins, minerals. I mean, all the, you know, mm-hmm. minutiae of all the right. details when you got right. a degree in nutrition. And so right. when I say I accidentally fell into it, I think that's mm-hmm. the case. But, you know, began to really get passionate about it and enjoy both the science of nutrition, but also, like you mentioned, the practical application that is actually right. about food, too, you know, that we eat and need and revolve our lives around in a lot of ways.
Wow. So with that, what made you decide to just hone in on, like, you know what, I want to actually teach this. How did you get into diabetes education?
Well, as a registered dietitian nutritionist, many people, particularly back then, started in hospital positions, as clinical dietitians, you know, and I worked as a dietitian for quite a few years early in my career in the hospital setting, with a variety of different type of patients. I ended up kind of focusing more on cardiac and cardiology based really? Patients, and then also some obesity practice, lipid control, all those kind of things. So I was in that, and inherent in that is education. You know, when patients were discharged from the hospital, they had certain, quote, diet orders that were given. And the dietitian's role was to give them, at the time, we just handed them brochures, you know, and very doubtful many of them were able to do much with that. But, wow. you know, going on in the clinical setting. And then when I came to Vanderbilt, I was able to get into a little different angle. It was not a hospital setting. It was more a university or community setting, doing health promotion with Vanderbilt faculty and staff, you know, just trying to teach positive lifestyle behaviors.
Right.
And then in 2000, again, just kind of falling into a position where a nutrition instructor at the university retired. And I was asked if I had interest in teaching. And so I was, yes. And so that's, I just kind of then began teaching undergraduate nutrition courses and taught that over 20 years. So was able to develop and hone that aspect of being able to deliver nutrition information in ways that people could understand it, remember it, and apply it to.
Right. So when I listened to the Nutrition 101 course, that I found on Audible, I told you, you know, in our previous conversation that I listened to that at least three times.
Wow.
Yeah, at least I told you I'm like your best student. And I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to figure out how to officially take one of you, because you're still teaching, right?
I am not teaching in the classroom anymore. After 43 straight semesters of teaching in the classroom, I decided to kind of step away and focus more on my textbook and focus more on some other projects.
So. Oh, nice. So I'm a student of yours. I'm like your favorite student from now on, you know, you're going to have to accept that. Okay. So as a registered dietitian nutritionist and teaching courses, what do you find that most students, when it comes to like weight and wanting to know about eating healthy, what do you find that they are wanting to know most about?
That's a great question. And the first assignment I gave for literally probably 15 of the 20 something years I taught was the first assignment they had was to submit one diet or nutrition question they wanted addressed during the semester. And I have thousands of these questions from my undergrads and they reflected what was trending, you know, intermittent fasting, keto, you know. Sometimes they would ask these questions like, what is a healthy diet? Which, like, right. Okay, I'm glad we have a semester to address that. They would ask about supplements. They would ask about plant-based diets. They would ask about gluten and GMOs and, you know, just all these, quote, hot topics is right. Oftentimes what the questions would be about. And some weight-related questions, but, you know, when you teach college-age students, you also have some issues with disordered eating in that population in particular. So you have to be conscious of that and how you teach nutrition in a way that isn't exacerbating that situation.
Right.
But actually hopefully frees them. In many ways. And, you know, so I was really, as you mentioned before, I'm pretty practical in the sense that I'm not a big believer at all in using words like avoid or restriction-based plans that they not only set you up oftentimes to fail, but they can also lead some individuals into issues with eating disorders. So, I don't like it when things say, stop, don't eat, don't this. Because I wouldn't want that rule in my life.
Right. And I'm glad you said that because it was so interesting when people started noticing that, you know, hey, Oscar's really big into nutrition and, you know, I'm posting a lot of content about, you know, healthy choices and so forth. You had some people were like, you know, I don't want to be eating bird food all the time, you know, and I don't want to just be eating salads. Salads are boring. I remember one person on TikTok, I did a TikTok video talking about the importance of remaining hydrated and drinking water. She flat out said, I'm not going to do that. Water is boring. I was like, I had the same mentality, but, you know, and so I gave some practical, you know, tips of how to flavor your water without, you know, with natural fruit or, you know, cucumber, you know, and stuff like that. So that's interesting, you know.
Yeah, you're right. And with water, you know, just as a side note, I remember sharing with my students about a study in kids that went to camp and they assessed their hydration status when they arrived, and then and most were dehydrated to some degree, even arriving in camp. Sorry, my glasses are fogging up on me, so I'm going to just clean them up. They, for the next 3 days, one day they gave them all water to drink, one day they gave them Gatorade, and one day they gave them flavored water, and looked at the level of hydration and how much they drank. And it went like Gatorade number one, they drank the most Gatorade, number two, flavored water, and number three, water. So, you know, I think you're right. I think people, if you just say cut out all sodas, cut out all this and just drink water, you're going to turn a lot of people off. You kind of got to find a way to, you know, keep it appealing and realistic. So
that makes sense.
That's a good point, though.
And that makes sense. You know, when I was looking at your book, you know, for my audience, I want them to know and I want them to get this book if they're really interested in learning more about, you know, nutrition science. And just even though it's a textbook, it actually is very, very practical. I've learned a lot from this book. I reference it often, you know, when I'm doing my own personal research and research when I'm talking to others. So it is The Nutrition for a Changing World. It's the second edition. You have to get this book. I know she co-authored it with Mr. Stephen
Nazilski. Yes. Right? And he is a nutrition biochemist.
Oh, wow.
Whereas I'm, you know, a registered dietitian nutritionist with lots of teaching experience. And he's taught as well. So that combination, I call him Steve, my science guy, because, you know, he keeps my facts checked and the he does the pathways and all the enzymes and those things that are like, to me. But yeah, it's great. And you were mentioning the textbook is from Macmillan Learning and then in partnership with Scientific American. So it takes a journalistic approach. So every chapter is the science is weaved into a story. So we chose stories for every chapter and worked with science writers and all kinds of things to make it more readable and engaging. And a lot of graphics and pictures too, just to kind of, you know, make the information a little more relevant and interesting. But and I apologize, textbooks are not cheap. So, you know, I apologize in advance on the pricing. If people realize what goes into writing a textbook and literally the hundreds of people that are involved from start to finish to production, you know, it's different than a lot of books it's on the market. You know, textbooks are very unique.
And even like the section, like I have several favorite sections. The one on carbs, I've read that I don't know how many times. The macronutrients, the vitamins, knowing the difference between water soluble vitamins and the minerals and all of this stuff. So when she's talking about illustrations, look at this, folks. I mean, it's high quality graphics. And, you know, I'm a marketing person, graphics person. And of course, I'm not just here pushing a book, just any book. You guys know I'm very honest. I don't have people on here just talking about supplements and just buy this and you're going to lose weight in like 20 seconds. You know, I don't believe in that. But I do recommend her book, and I kind of want to get into some of the topics in the book, because when you talk about people who are wanting to be more health conscious, whether they have type 2 diabetes or not, you know, weight is a big issue that a lot of people are concerned about, you know, and because Jamie has experience in weight management, Jamie, I really want you to help us to understand, you know, what are some of the links between a poor health and poor nutrition?
Well, you know, diet, let me step back a moment. When people say, what's a healthy diet? One of the ways that it was framed was in a position paper from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics that was really targeted more at kids. But they gave four variables or factors or points about what a healthy diet is. And the first one was a healthy diet supplies your needs. Gives you your vitamins, your minerals, you know, the things that you need for your body to work, all the processes, all the pathways, you know, your metabolic processes, everything relies on adequate intake of certain vitamins and minerals. And, you know, we've identified, not me, but of course, scientists and experts have identified how much we need of most of these to function. So the first one is that it supplies your needs. The second one is that it helps you attain or maintain a healthy body weight. That a healthy diet provides your needs, that it has the appropriate amount of energy, you know, activity versus intake to attain or maintain a healthy weight. Number three is that it helps prevent disease, that, you know, the diet is such that, say, it's lower in saturated fat, sodium, added sugars, that the healthy diet would be one that helps people offset risk of chronic disease. But then the fourth one, which I really appreciate, is that a healthy diet fosters an enjoyment of eating. So it's really a multi-prong. So diet definitely plays a role in disease. I mean, across the spectrum, certainly in terms of increasing risk of obesity, type 2 diabetes, cancer, heart disease, you know, osteoporosis. I mean, the list is almost endless of diet's role in many of these. And now with more and more research and more attention on gut health, you know, diet certainly plays a huge role in attaining and maintaining a healthy gut. And that plays a role in a lot of disease, the etiology and, you know, prevention and treatment of diseases. So,
right.
you know, diet just plays into everything. Mm. And there was a recent study that came out, and I think you commented on it in my Facebook page, that they attribute about 70% or more of type 2 cases to diet. Mm. And specifically people having, you know, excess refined grains, wheat, rice, you know, ultra processed foods, processed meats, that, you know, they, in looking at many in a meta-analysis, that, you know, consumption of certain categories of food seem to dramatically increase risk and play a role in causing diabetes.
Well, you know what, you know, with that being said, sorry to interrupt.
Oh, there, we could go on. So please ask me your question.
Yeah. So because of that, you know, what do you say to those people who say, well, you know, diseases are pretty much mostly genetic based and diet or what I eat really plays very little into leading to certain health risks? Is really just genetics. If my mom had this and my dad had this or my aunt had this or great grandparent had this, then I'm predisposed to it and there's nothing that we can do about it.
Well, I think you have to acknowledge that, yes, genetics plays certainly a role. And I think it varies, just like everything is individual, you know, that we all have. I mean, I've seen some nutrition and health experts say genetics only plays about a 10% role in your health and your, you know, risk of disease. Others say it's half, you know, but it's not 100%. Right. There used to be a saying that says genetics loads the gun and environment pulls the trigger. Wow. That, you know, we are what we are. And the environment that we're in, our lifestyle certainly is going to affect how that plays out. And so, you know, yes, even if you have a strong genetic predisposition,
right,
you can mitigate or delay onset of disease by a healthy lifestyle. And it doesn't have to be a purist lifestyle. You know, but just throwing your hands up and saying, well, here it comes, you know, is not the best approach. That, but also acknowledging that, yes, some of us are more predisposed to weight gain, to certain disease states than others.
And because I grew up in a Caribbean household, I may have mentioned that to you.
Yes. So,
you know, for us, you know, rice, and let's say certain breads and pastries were maybe a staple. And yeah, we may have seen certain people who are overweight in our family. Like me, I was pretty thin growing up, you know. My parents were on the more on the heavier side. But then I look at like nephews and cousins who are like lanky, you know. And then for myself, I didn't really gain weight like and become overweight until I was probably in my 30s. You know what I'm saying? Late 30s. And then my weight would just kind of fluctuate. But then it wasn't until like 45, 46, 47 that I really ballooned. And I know for sure that was my diet. You know what I mean? So with that being said, talking about diet, you know, what are your thoughts on the standard or what's called SAD, the standard American diet, and what people are surrounded with in our modern day environment here in the U.S.?
You know, you hear terms like we live in a toxic food environment. We live in an obesogenic environment, which means, you know, the way our lives are built, the way the world is, you know, around us, that it favors development of obesity, particularly in those that are genetic predisposed.
Right.
So, you know, and if you look at the American diet across the board, we tend to eat too little of the things we're supposed to, quote, eat more of, like, you know, vegetables, fruits, whole grains, fiber, and we tend to eat more of the things that we're advised to eat less of. The sodium, the added sugars, the saturated fats, those kind of things. So we are skewed. And if you compare that to what's recommended, say through the dietary guidelines for Americans, we're really off. And they do healthy eating index scoring. And when you look at it across the life, across the lifespan, the two groups that have the highest score, and still that's in the low 60s out of 100, would be young children, like, you know, toddler age, and older adults. And partly it's because toddlers, their parents are controlling, or they're, you know, who's caring for them, their diet. They're not making their own choices. The lowest score is in teens, in terms of this healthy eating index, where they're taking more responsibility and making more independent food choices, often based on environment and culture and all those things. And then as people get older, they get a little more health conscious, thinking of sometimes their own mortality and begin to make better choices. So, you know, our diet is certainly not the best. And, you know, we're seeing more, but yet it's not entirely an individual thing. I mean, it's when you look at, you know, what influences what we eat, it's policy, it's the food industry, it's, you know, availability, it's access, so many variables that play in, and certainly individual choice, preference, and taste play in, but we're so influenced by so much that it's a multi-level, you know, if we want to change obesity in this country, which now I think the stats are that over 70% of Americans are either overweight or obese. I mean, that's the norm. Our norm is overweight or obese. And, you know, obesity levels are well into the 30%, and in some states over 40%, you know, actually clinical obesity. So, you know, and certainly our food environment, our food quote, systems almost support that. In combination with, you know, to be active takes intentional effort. That, you know, the typical, if you don't try, you can be very sedentary in this world. You have to, you know, you almost have to be intentional as well with your diet. And that doesn't mean rigorous. That doesn't mean, you know, where it's so hard, but it does take intentional choice. Because if you go with the flow in most areas of this country, that flow is not going to necessarily end up well for you. You know, when people travel abroad to some countries, you know, where the norm is a little different, they often even come home losing weight because, you know, just the diet is different. The activity level is different. So here it ain't so easy.
Man, and when you talk about traveling, you know, I told you my parents are from the Caribbean. So my mom's side is that they're Jamaican, right?
Yes.
So I remember in the early 80s going to Jamaica. I was born in the States, but going to Jamaica for the first time and visiting relatives. Back then, I met an aunt, a great grand aunt or something. She was 106 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Vibrant. She wasn't, you know, leaning over. She was living in the country, in the hills. And I mean, when you talk about, I guess, a blue zone, they didn't call them blue zones. And I guess, I don't know. But there wasn't a lot of the poor eating choices. You know what I'm saying? And of course, you know, you're talking about environment, eating off the land, you know, eating more fresh vegetables and fruit and stuff like that. And so I remember as a kid, I was like, where is KFC? Where's Burger King? You know, and when I found out that there was probably one KFC at the time in Jamaica, I was upset. And and then when we went, it did not taste the same. I'm like, what is this? You know, but now you come here in the US, you can find KFC, Popeyes, Bojangles, all these fast food restaurants on every corner in certain neighborhoods.
Yes.
And in others, you know, when you talk about access, you have a Whole Foods like, or Sprouts, and it makes it easier to get healthier food yes. options, you know.
Yeah, it's so. Yeah. They call them, you know, now food swamps are more strongly correlated with development and maintenance of obesity states than food deserts. You know, food swamps are where you have an abundance of, you know, easily accessible restaurants, convenience stores in an area, and even having a full service grocery store in those food swamp areas doesn't necessarily change the outcome. Right. That, you know, still you have too much. The proportion of those is too great compared because you don't have to cook. They're relatively affordable. You can get a lot for $5 at a lot of those places, you know. Right. You don't have to prepare, and, you know, and certainly the advertising and the ease is a big part of it. So, you know, I don't mean to, it almost sounds fatalistic, but, you know, but, you know, we can do a lot. I'm a big, proponent of environmental control, and that's a strong word, or management, where you try to make your environment as conducive to your goals as you can. And it doesn't mean it has to be a purist situation, but, you know, if you don't have in your own kitchen, certain things available and accessible, you're not going to eat them. And likewise, if you have a lot of the other type foods, you're going to consume them, you know, because they're so available. Right. You know, just setting up your kitchen in such a way that you're more likely to eat like you want to eat. And it doesn't mean not having the other things, but it may even mean keeping them less visible. Because you see it, you know, you want it. So you just sometimes have to, like, even put things behind things and make other things more visible. It was during when COVID hit and more people were eating at home and constantly had kitchen access. That was a challenge for a lot of people, you know, because when they went to work, they didn't have continual access to kitchen. Or food. Right. And then all of a sudden you just can get up and go get in the kitchen, open that fridge, open the pantry. It was always there. And, you know, so it was one of the contributors to people snacking more often. You know, and plus the whole aura of making yourself feel better, the comfort, the comfort aspect of it too, during all that. So it was kind of a recipe for, weight gain for some people.
Right. And speaking of that, you actually recently put up a post about, well, it wasn't recently, but it was some time ago about pandemic, living. And I believe you even put out a video, which is very informative about healthy eating during the pandemic. And now, you know, we're considered post-pandemic in certain respects. However, the effects of the pandemic is still there on mental health and even diet choices, because you do have more and more people who are working from home and opting to stay at home.
Yes.
So how would you like to speak into that, even for people who are working from home? You talked a little about your home environment and making it more conducive for healthier eating options. Can you elaborate a little bit more?
Well, I think stock your kitchen with foods you enjoy, but maybe aren't so energy dense, you know, to snack on, and try to stay on schedule as much as possible. It's when you're just, I mean, even for me, when I'm home all day long, it's hard to have actual meals, you know, you end up just kind of grazing throughout the day and you lose track. Not that you have to count everything or follow, but you kind of lose track. And it also can kind of mess up your body's regulation of its own hunger. You know, that when we eat on a fairly regular schedule, your body kind of aligns with that in terms of giving you hunger signals and things.
Right.
So if you graze all day, you never really allow your body to get hungry.
Right.
And you can end up eating sometimes substantially more for some people less actually, but others substantially more. So trying to stay on a schedule, stock in your kitchen in such a way with things that you enjoy. And, you know, when I, you know, was many years ago when I lived by myself, I would, if I bought a carton of ice cream, that was a danger. I mean, because who could eat at the time? The serving size was like a half a cup, which was pretty pitiful. You know, that was really hard to portion control. But if you bought individual ice cream bars, or things that are pre-portioned for you, that helped a lot, you know, then that's your serving. Instead of trying to eat from the bag of chips or something, you know, putting a certain amount in a bowl or something. And because it's, you know, and they've done studies, say, with popcorn in theaters, that people tend to consume at least 2/3 of a bucket of popcorn, regardless of the size of the bucket. So it's just sort of like, because you're there, you're eating. And they found even when people got stale popcorn on purpose, they still ate like that much, just, you know, kind of out of habit and sitting there. And, you know, so just how we set up our environment, the even the size of the bowls and cups and plates we use influences it. You know, that for cereal, for example, if you have a great big bowl, you're going to, people typically will eat more. Because even if they fill it halfway. So there's all these little tricks, that people do. So, you know,
so then even drilling down, let's say from, and we'll get into a little bit more about, diet choices or food choices, but what I'm hearing is if it's within arm's reach, right? Or if it's visually, if your home environment or your workspace, let's say if you're at home, or even if you're working in an office, if your office, your desk is close to a vending machine, if your desk, if you have in your drawer the little snacks that you put your peanuts in, I'm not saying anything bad about peanuts, but those snack foods, you
where
know,
they're so accessible,
where they're so accessible, is going to make it harder for you to not graze, because grazing, for those who don't know, you know, it's like, you know, when the cows are grazing, they just kind of go along and they're eating whatever they find. They eat and keep eating. They stop and they keep eating. And you can probably speak more to that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a researcher who does a lot of the studies, like with the popcorn, but he also did one with jelly beans in an office setting where he had them set out, and people didn't really realize what he was doing, had them set out on their plate, on their desk, like a little bowl. Other people, they were in their desk drawer. And then in other areas of the office, they were readily available in the break room. And you can imagine, you know, who ate the most. You ate the most when they were right there on your desk,
right?
Followed by they were in your drawer, but they were out of sight unless you opened your drawer.
Right.
And versus having to get up and walk to the break room and eat them there and in the presence of potentially other people. So you added that little social deterrent there too. So, you know, in some ways, like when I used to teach weight management, we would sometimes help people figure out how to put more steps between, and I don't necessarily mean physical steps, but it can be. But, you know, like going back to popcorn, if you don't buy the ready popped popcorn in the bags, like the Smart Pop or all that, which there's nothing wrong with that. But if you don't have that in, but you still have popcorn that you have to pop yourself, that's a extra step. You can't just grab it. So the more steps you put between you and the food, the less likely, or the more, you won't just grab and go all the time.
Right.
So it's more that conscious, and I'm not a big, advocate of calorie counting, but in some situations it can be a basis to kind of give people an idea of, say, what does 1800 calories feel like, look like?
Right.
What does this eat look like? And then you kind of stop doing that, but because you can get really obsessed with, but I think there is some awareness is still very important. And sometimes logging things, whether on one of the apps or, on paper, whether or not you count the calories, can serve a purpose, but you have to be cautious with that too.
Right.
Where you get overly focused on it. So
with that being said, earlier you mentioned about energy density, right? And energy dense food and so forth. So some people, they're thinking, okay, well, I'm just focusing on calories versus I'm just focusing on carbs, and really not understanding the connection. So if you will, what should people know about carbs and calories, and what should they focus on when they're trying to lose weight?
Oh gosh, that's quite the question.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of foundations. Calories are not created equal, and we are increasingly realizing calories in versus calories out doesn't always mathematically add up to the weight loss that people are expecting. That there's so many factors and variables that come into play. When you look at energy density, which I mentioned earlier, fat has the highest energy density, which means, and that's not to say healthy fats aren't a very important part of our diets, but fat has 9 calories per gram of weight. So it's very dense. Protein and carb average about 4 calories per gram. So fat adds up quicker in terms. And the other thing with fat, if you think about it, it doesn't add bites to your diet. So if you fry a piece of chicken, you get the same number of bites as you would if you baked it.
Right.
If you fry potatoes, you get the same number of bites as if, they were baked or boiled. If you, add salad dressing to a salad, which, salad dressing is pretty high in fat. I'm not saying it's bad, but you don't get more bites out of that salad. When you add butter and sour cream to a baked potato, you don't get more bites. When you add mayonnaise to a sandwich, you don't get more bites, because fat really doesn't have much volume. It's more, it's more of a flavoring almost. So in the, when I first started working in Vanderbilt in the 80s and 90s, we used a low-fat approach in weight management to help people reduce overall energy intake, calorie intake, by reducing fat with less focus on calories. The problem with that was people began abusing carbohydrates, that they found pretzels were zero fat. Non-fat frozen yogurt was zero fat. Many of your cereals are zero fat. So they began over-consuming those. And that's not the answer either. So I don't think you need to focus just on fat. You don't need to focus just on calories or just on carbs. But I think it is the quality of those carbs, the quality of those fats. Like, we need healthy fats. We need the monos, the polys. We need the omega-3s. You know, we need healthy fats. And carbs, quality carbs, are the ones that tend to be higher in fiber, you know, have more nutrition per serving, so to speak, and to reduce the amount of the refined type carbohydrates. Your qualities would be your non-starchy vegetables, your whole grain breads, cereals, those kind of things. Your, your legumes, your, you know, root vegetables, all those kind of things tend to be more your quality carbs. So carbs are not a villain. You know, they provide glucose for our brain. They fuel us. And a diet that's low in carbohydrate tends to naturally be higher in fat, because you make up the calories somewhere, or higher in protein. So I would say that for me personally, if I had to advocate for one approach, which I don't think there is just one approach, but I would say something that employs the energy density as the foundation, is because you can, if you choose foods that are lower in energy density, for the emphasize those. It doesn't mean you don't have the others, but emphasize low energy dense foods. You can eat more for less. And I think that is, you know, I want to eat more. So, you know, focusing on the, and if you look at many of the popular weight loss programs out there, like I had a couple of friends use Noom, and I actually signed up just and then canceled it. And it's been funny. I can't, you know, I did the 2-week free trial just to get a sense of what are they teaching. And it was very energy dense based. That was what they employed, was the energy density. But I didn't renew it. You know, I'd canceled the thing. And then it was a certain amount a month. And then they said, how about this much a month? How about that much a month? How about another 6 months free? You know, so they kept going, trying to get me back. But I didn't go back. But I was just curious about what was the foundation of Noom. Weight Watchers uses pretty much a energy dense type foundation, that what they, you know, the things with the quote lowest points when they use points were low energy dense foods. And plant-based diets are inherently lower in energy density. So like Mediterranean, DASH, some of those type more, you know, that, because plants tend not to be as energy dense as, you know, other foods. The things that raise energy density are fat, sugar, and alcohol.
So fat, sugar, and alcohol
raise energy density. The things that lower energy density are fluid or water. So things like plants have more water in them, you know, and fiber. Fiber lowers energy density. So if I told, I used to say, if I had people count anything, it would be fiber. Count fiber. Because we way under eat fiber. And just trying to eat more fiber means, and you only get fiber through plant foods. So you're going to be eating more whole grains, you know, vegetables, beans, legumes, those kind of things, if you're trying to up your fiber.
And also protein, As we age, would you say we definitely need, not necessarily having to count protein, but we definitely need to make sure we get an adequate amount of protein,
Excellent point. Excellent point. Most people in the U.S. don't need to worry about that. If you look at what's recommended, and that just means minimum. We, for males and females both, we tend to well exceed that if you look at the typical diet. We are not protein deficient in the U.S. Across the board. Now, the aging adult, sometimes that's a challenge.
Because they're eating less sometimes.
They're eating less overall, and their food choices may alter. So, yes, the RDA doesn't increase it yet for aging adult, but all the research is pointing that way, that just to support and maintain lean mass that or fat-free mass, we need we need ample protein as we age. But that doesn't mean a high protein diet. That just means making sure you're getting enough protein in. But I'm going all over the place.
No, you're good. So even – because here's the other thing too, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you're eating too much protein, that protein could, that excess protein can lead to excess weight.
Well, it, you know, your body needs a certain amount of protein. Going significantly above that amount, it's not going to use it for protein needs. I mean, you've met them.
Right.
So then it becomes an energy source rather than functioning in what, you know, your body needs in terms of protein and amino acids. And yes, it can contribute to the energy pool. So excess intake, if it's above your whole day, like if you're consuming consistently more than your energy needs, then excess protein can, it does go through different pathways and it's your body, it's a little more expensive for your body to use certain, macronutrients for energy and depositing as fat than it does some of the other ones. Okay. So, you know, there's a lot that goes into it, but,
So with that being said, you know, okay, I get people who ask me, okay, Oscar, I'm going to the grocery store. How do I start? And I know we've kind of talked to, you know, bits and pieces here or there about how to start. You know, you have people again who are looking at, okay, I need to count carbs or count calories. And they, a lot of folks like me at the time, I rarely ever looked at the back, you know, of a food product, you know, and I'm in marketing. So all I did was focus, you know, on the front. If there was a health claim, okay, yeah, great. A lot of people shop by what's on the front of the packaging, but can you talk, you know, more about the food labeling and what things we should really pay attention to when we're making, healthier choices or food choices?
Well, again, it's going to kind of depend on people's goals and such. If you look at what people typically look at first is calories. Mm. Most people look at calories first, even though most of them, if you ask, wouldn't know what their daily needs are. So they don't know the context of those calories. They just think the lower, the better, you know, and so that's not necessarily always true. Right. You know, you can get overwhelmed if you try to look at all the numbers, and most people don't even know how they play out. Like sodium is in the hundreds or the thousands.
Right.
Cholesterol's oftentimes single digits or around, you know, like, so where does that come from? So, you know, that DV value, that daily value that's next to it is kind of telling you what percent that food contributes to your daily value. And in some points, the daily value is like your goal that you want to reach. In other ones, it's kind of like, don't go over this. Like if something says this contributes, you know, 30% of your daily value of dietary cholesterol or saturated fat.
Right.
Or sugar. That doesn't mean you want to keep eating more so you can get to 100. That just means. Right. So, you know, it's kind of set up in sections in terms of things to eat more of and things to eat less of. Right. I look at fiber a lot. Serving size is kind of important to note. The revised food label that was revised several years ago, they bolded calories.
Yeah, made it bigger too.
Bigger and bolded. And they changed some of the serving sizes to be more realistic. Mm-hmm. Like they changed ice cream from half a cup, which was the standardized amount, to 2/3 cup. So some people said, oh, my ice cream got more calories in it. And it's because it's telling you what was more typical of consumption, instead of the half cup. You know, they took away percent calories from fat off the label because people weren't really using that value. Right. So, I mean, I hate to sound so vague. There is a big push now to do more front of package, like you mentioned, labeling, where it identifies foods that are higher potentially in sodium, added sugar, saturated fat, and identifying foods that are provide, say, more fiber or more of certain vitamins and minerals. You know, when you look at research on food labels, people tend to look at them the first time or two they purchase them, and then they don't look again. You know, that they tend to use the label for new food products,
right,
or they use it to compare between similar products,
right,
to see, you know, what are the differences there. Mm-hmm. I wish we had, and this may be coming at some point, more point of purchase or like grocery store shelf education for people. There was a program called NuVal that was out for a while that ranked food based on 35 parameters and gave it a score between 0 and 100. Like blueberries and salmon had high scores. White bread had like a score of 10, you know, and you could see its NuVal score. And it didn't mean you didn't eat the lower scores. It just means you emphasized the ones with higher scores. But that kind of went away. You know, I feel like when people shop, to think about variety, balance, think about, you know, what meals you have coming up, whether you're going to be eating at home or away, or whether you need something you can just, you know, microwave and eat. You know, I am really careful about buying fresh vegetables, particularly because unless I have a plan for them, you know, unless I know I'm going to be preparing something in the next few days, they get really unappealing and, you know, they do lose some of their nutrition. So even though I think it's a great thing, I think you need to think about how you're going to use them and when you're going to use them.
Right.
Not just stock up on them because they can lose their quality and even lose some of their nutrition. Right. I'm a big frozen vegetable person. I mean, my freezer is full of frozen vegetables because they actually are packaged the day they're harvested. So they retain a lot of their inherent nutrition, where they're not going from the field to a distributor, from the distributor to the store, from the store to your refrigerator, you know. So you don't have that span of time where they can, it's not they lose all their nutrition, but certainly some and quality can change. So I love frozen vegetables. I've always felt I should work for Green Giant or one of those companies because it's a core in our household. And even canned vegetables, you know, are convenient and they're not unnutritious. Sometimes they do have more sodium.
Sodium, right, for preserving.
Yeah.
Right.
But you can also buy the lower sodium varieties.
True.
Or you can rinse quite a bit of that off. So if you run like a can of canned green beans under your, in a drain strainer, you can take off about almost 50% of the sodium. So, you know, canned, frozen, and just eating more of vegetables and fruits. I tend to say instead of fruits and vegetables, I try to say vegetables and fruits. Not that fruits aren't great, but I think vegetables, really give you more in a lot of ways. So, you know, not to say don't eat fruit, but and do eat fruit, but vegetables.
I like that. I like that's very practical because I found for myself, I used to say, okay, I'm going to buy a big thing from Costco or BJ's of spinach or spring mix, and I'm going to make all this salad. But if you don't have a plan, and a lot of times, I would eat, you know, every other day, make my own salad every day for lunch or whatever. But then there was a lot of spoilage that would happen, you know, and I like that. What you mentioned about having a plan for your food when you go to the grocery store, even before you set foot in a grocery store, having a plan. What is it that I know that I'm working on with this weight gain or reversing my cholesterol? Is it, you know, lowering my blood sugar and so forth? So having a plan before you go to the store. And then when you bring that food home, you know, freezing the vegetables, you know, or getting canned vegetables. So, you know, you can go ahead and, you know, be practical about how you're going to use this this food. So you're eliminating waste and so forth. So
yeah, because really there's a lot of waste. And yeah, salads, of course, you can't do frozen or, right. or canned. Right. But, you know, even the bag salads and checking the expiration date on those or the use by sell by date on those. So that those are packaged, they're sealed. Sure. And those sometimes will last longer than if buying. And I'm certainly not trying to say don't buy fresh fruits and vegetables.
Right.
But but I think they're wonderful. But, you know.
So let me ask you a question. Kind of switching gears. You good? Do you need to take a break real quick?
Nope, I'm fine. Thank
okay,
you.
Cool. So liquid calories. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about that because you mentioned about Gatorade earlier. And I think there was a podcast episode that I talked about sweetened and artificially sweetened drinks. And I think you had posted something around the same time. And I was like, wow, this is divine. We're both talking about the same thing, you know, within days of each other. So when it comes to liquid calories and being specific about certain drinks, can you speak to that a little bit?
I think if people are trying to reduce overall intake, that liquid calories are one of the best and easiest ways to do that, particularly if they're drinking sugar sweetened beverages like sodas or, you know, some of the fruit drinks and, you know, even Gatorade. Most people, unless you are a professional athlete or really, really exercising, you don't need those sports drinks. You know, they're just popular and taste good to many people. They're more habit. But yeah, liquid calories go down easy and add up quick. You know, if you think about one of those biggies at a fast food restaurant, those can run 400, 500 calories. Wow. You know, when you think of one of the bigger ones, if you've got a regular soda, for example, which for some people, that's a quarter or 20% of their day just in liquid. I'd much rather chew and bite calories than I would drink them down. So, you know, consider where your liquid calories are coming from. And like we mentioned earlier, it doesn't have to be all water. You know, we get hydration from a variety of sources. I mean, even coffee is hydrating. That people think it's not, but it actually, you know, there's unless you're drinking a lot, it really doesn't have a diuretic effect. You know, any fluid is hydrating. So your flavored waters, like you mentioned, your seltzers, your unsweetened teas and coffees all can, you know, it doesn't all have to be water. Certainly water is a great choice and having, you know, that throughout the day. But some people are, you know, you see them sitting at their desk with these massive things of water. And it's like, my goal is to drink 15 cups today. It's like,
My body.
Yeah. And we get about 25% of our fluid from food, you know, through vegetables and fruits and things like that are a contributor to our fluid. And, you know, when I did a lot of weight management, I remember having a client who drank, I want to say, I'm trying to remember, like at least 2 liters, maybe three of Mountain Dew every day, regular Mountain Dew, and kept it next to their chair and just drank it all day long. Really? So what was the interim for that person? You know, the first one was to reduce that amount. But, you know, we said, just drink diet. Try not to drink 3 gallons of it because that's probably too much. But as an interim strategy. But if you told that person, stop drinking your Mountain Dew and drink only water, you know, they probably would never come back to see you again.
And so their bodies are not ready for it.
No. So you have to kind of strategize what's realistic for people. But regular sodas and sugar sweetened beverages add up. And diet sodas are not necessarily the answer. I think in moderation, they can be helpful for some people. Kind of depends. My daughter said that she's had friends say, you know, the regular are healthier than the diet. Mm. Well, you know, it all kind of, again, depends. All the approved artificial or non-nutritive sweeteners on the market are classified as generally recognized as safe or GRAS substances, which means they're approved for use at certain amounts in our food supply, and that, you know, extreme adverse effects have not been reported. But that doesn't mean that they're completely safe.
Right.
I think we're learning a lot more. I think, you know, occasional use is okay. Mm. And I think sometimes as an interim strategy to reduce intake of regular, quote, sodas, it might work. But when you look at the data, you really don't see a lot of difference between regular soda drinkers and diet soda drinkers in terms of weight change or obesity levels. That it may be people are compensating, you know, like, well, I had a Diet Coke, so I'm going to have this. It's not like a remedy to lose weight, switching to diet soda. The other thing, and I would demonstrate this in my classroom, I would often ask, does anybody have a Diet Coke in the class? You know, and I would have an apple with me. And somebody would raise their hand, or a Diet Pepsi, whatever. And if you are exercising or you just eat an apple, it's pretty sweet. But if you drink diet soda, and then you take a bite of that apple, it tastes bitter because you're comparing the threshold has changed. So
what's going to taste bitter?
The apple, because you're comparing it to that intense sweet of the diet soda.
Right.
So, you know, if you pair an apple with a diet soda, the apple ain't going to taste that great because, you know, the diet soda. So it can diet sodas and even regular sodas can change your taste threshold where you don't taste the sweetness that's naturally in other foods. So, you know, fruit won't taste as sweet. So sometimes I would challenge people to forego for a while and then experience apples and fruit and things, you know, and all of a sudden those taste sweeter and a little more satisfying. But, you know, we just kind of change our threshold by these very concentrated sweet things where other foods just don't naturally taste sweet. Like carrots are naturally sweet. Apples are naturally sweet.
Right.
But if you paired them, that doesn't sound appealing to me at all. A diet soda.
Right.
You know, if you have a diet soda, people mostly would reach for Doritos or crackers, something salty.
But that's really insightful, because what I find is when people buy something healthy, or they perceive it to be healthier as an option, or a healthier option, like a diet soda, some people feel like, okay, that's licensed to get a bag of chips as well.
Yeah, because I'm saving these calories.
Right. Because the diet drink is helping me to actually lose weight, when that's not really how that actually works.
No.
Biologically, it doesn't work like that. Metabolically, it doesn't work like that. You know.
Yeah. And we're learning more too about how, like, just to say about non-nutritive sweeteners and artificially sweetened beverages are also changing our gut microbiome.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's affecting our gut. There's some things in terms of, you know, what's it doing with insulin and some of those things, because your body's detecting sweet. And so what's happening inside? So, you know, I think the message is, it's good to moderate those, just not have a lot, or avoid them and have other type beverages. But, you know, I admit, sometimes a Diet Coke on ice sounds amazing to me. You know, it's just like, yes, I just want a Diet Coke over ice. And I don't have them every day. I don't even necessarily have them every week, but You know, I also don't have it on my forbidden list.
Right.
That, you know, sometimes it's just really good. So,
And I think I like what you said earlier, you know, it depends on where a person is in their journey, right? You have like how it was for me, I was 268 pounds and I wanted to reverse type 2 diabetes, but I didn't know about reversing it. I knew that I wanted to eventually get off meds one day. My doctor said, hey, you need to start losing weight, you know, start taking insulin shots, take this metformin pill. You also have high blood cholesterol. You're dealing with all these other things. So I knew deep down that I needed to make a change for me. And the more I started researching nutrition and I started realizing, okay, that's what empty calories mean. That's what, you know, vitamin deficiency can lead to. So I'm like, you know what? I want to start putting in my body things that my body can actually use for fuel, healthy.
I like
options.
That perspective. Yes.
You know, so rather than just go at it from this perspective, I'm like, what is it that my body actually needs? So it made it easier for me to switch from the lemonades, the sweet teas. It didn't happen overnight. It took a while, but I had to clear out my environment. I had to stop going to the smoothie place to get a 32-ounce drink that I thought was a healthy meal replacement, but it was just a sugar bomb. But I didn't know that. I didn't know about that until I started educating myself more and more. What is my body supposed to do? What does my body look like on sugar versus what it's not? You know. So eventually being able to reverse type 2 diabetes by losing over 80 pounds. Now, I believe at some point it didn't take me 80 pounds to reverse it. At some point between 268 and 186, things really changed. And I can attribute it to cutting back on the high carbs, cutting back and even eliminating the sugary drinks. I'm a cold turkey person. I know a lot of people are not like that, but I didn't want to die and I did not want to lose any limbs. Yeah. And I just hunkered down, Jamie. And I was like, I'm going to exercise. I'm going to be less sedentary. I'm going to learn as much as I can and not just have a head knowledge, but actually put a lot of this stuff into practice.
And kudos to you. Kudos to you. But I think it's important too for people to know that losing 80 pounds is not always realistic, certainly, or even necessarily necessary. That you see pretty significant metabolic changes with, say, even 7 to 10% of weight change that people can lose. You know, say 7-10% and maybe find a way to stay and live there. You know, because it can be pretty overwhelming when you look at the magnitude of change like that you had to make, because your life now at 180 versus at 260 is different. I mean, you're living differently, you're moving differently, you're eating differently. And if somebody's making changes, you can't go back. You can't lose weight and go back. Because if you go back, your weight's going to gradually go back up. So you have to find things you can live with and sustain, and that you're willing to do. And I remember one time at a conference, somebody saying, you know, most people know two things they could do that would make a big difference. And just start with those, you know, like cutting out or reducing sugar sweetened beverages, reducing portion of this, or, you know, changing what you're snacking on at night. You know, just things most people know kind of what it is. And just, you know, sometimes I say tweaking, let's just tweak. And I think that awareness, though, is huge. I mean, becoming more aware of what your choices are, what you're snacking on, the portions you're consuming, you know, that first step and then kind of stepping back and saying, okay, where am I willing to make a change? Mm. You know, where, and sometimes you need to find the things that are as painless as possible. And, you know, I think that's one reason I really appreciate the energy density approach is because you're not restricting volume as much that way.
Right,
Because most people want some volume, you know, to feel satisfied. Slowing down your eating. I mean, there's so many strategies. And one thing I did want to share too, and we've kind of alluded to this, is in nutrition, when people ask questions, usually I open almost every answer. And also as a side note, I rarely say I can answer questions.
Right.
I say I can address them.
Right.
Because science is changing. What we're learning is changing. So to say you can give a definitive answer in this field is hard. So you can say, well, I can address that, you know, based on what we know now. But answer is harder. But most of the time I start answers or addressing with, it depends. It depends. Mm-hmm. It depends on the base diet, you know, is this bad? Well, it depends, you know, like for me, I eat primarily plant-based. It's just kind of how I eat now. It's like my default, is, you know, having a piece of birthday cake bad for me? No, because, you know, it's in the scheme of things. No, but if I had cake every single night, after dinner, that probably wouldn't be so great, you know, but again, it depends. It depends. Right. So it's all in context of our overall food choices. It's all in context of our own health needs, our own activity levels, whether, you know, it depends, plays out. But just going back to type 2 diabetes, there's been quite a bit come out in the last year looking at, you know, not only prevention and treatment, but also survival of individuals with diabetes and what kind of dietary choices play in. And a big one that comes up all the time is whole grains. And, you know, reducing significantly the intake of refined grains and eating more whole grains, that some studies show by eating more whole grains, you actually see reductions not only in incidence, but in mortality. So, you know, finding ways to incorporate more fiber and, of course, non-starchy vegetables, healthy fats, you know, those kind of things. And, reducing intake of most ultra processed foods, not all correlate with diabetes. And I think ultra processed foods are kind of part of our food environment now. It's just finding ways to, again, not emphasize those. Kids, they say, eat about 70% of their calories now from ultra processed foods. You know, but not all are bad. I mean, frozen vegetables are processed. They're not ultra, but, you know, they're processed. Know, most, and you just can't almost live now without some processed food just for convenience. And because I've had people say, oh, I only eat a whole food diet. And it's like, okay, how much time do you spend in your kitchen every day? You know, it's like, oh my gosh, I just not going to go there. So it's interesting, but.
And I'm glad you said that. And I mean, we can go on and on and with this.
I know.
Things that we, you know, how we get together when we start talking, you know, about pre-diabetes and diabetes, specifically type 2 diabetes. Unfortunately, I've been hearing more and more reports of people going after these fad diets, or they connect with someone who makes who consider themselves a health or nutrition coach, and they're charging people this exorbitant amount of money. Like, I heard one person was about to sign up for a program that was $12,000.
Oh my gosh.
And that's like literally $12,000 just to tell them, hey, this is your meal plan. This is what you need to do, X, Y, Z. And I'm like, Jamie, I didn't do any of that. I didn't sign up for any program. And I'm not against people doing it, but I'm against people being taken advantage of. So I want to, I know I get on my soapbox, as I mentioned to you before, but you know, from you, from your perspective, what are some things that people should really be mindful of when, you know, they may be desperate to lose weight, they may be desperate to reverse type 2 diabetes, and they're getting bombarded with all of these promises that people make? You know, there's, I think we talked about the weight loss pill and all these different things. Kind of speak to that as a word of caution, if you will, or what people should look out for.
Well, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And, you know, you have to be really careful of the promises and claims. And I really appreciate, Oscar, in our discussions, how you on your own do research and look for the evidence, because anecdotal evidence is not truly evidence, you know. That you have to really look at the good research, the meta-analysis, looking at all the kind of things. And yes, nutrition, diet, weight loss is an area where there's so much abuse. And people want to hear some of these kind of things, these promises. And, you know, they see the pictures or they hear the stories and they hear the claims. And, you know, you just have to really be careful, you know, talk to your healthcare provider. But I do think, you know, people do well, most people, with some support. And most people do well with some level of accountability. So those programs sometimes are giving you accountability and support. And that's not a negative thing, but you can also find that sometimes other places, or finding someone that has similar goals, you know, agreeing to meet at the gym or at the park for a walk, or, you know, somewhere where you're accountable to show up, is important. You know, I don't know. It's not easy. And you know, there's few areas that have been as exploited as weight management. And oftentimes, you know, I have this vivid memory when my youngest daughter was in competitive cheer and all the mamas would go out to dinner. And I remember one night going, and like six of them were doing keto. And they going, one of the moms goes, "Queso is keto." And I'm like, "No, not really, but okay, whatever." And the one mom and I were like, "Well, we're going to have this instead." I mean, I wasn't going to, I said to her, I said, "Let's just see if they're doing this in 2 months." And no, they weren't. I mean, if it's just unsustainable, you know, within your family life, it isn't going to last. And, you know, many people think of a diet as something you go on and go off, when really you need to find a way to eat, not diet. Learn how to eat, not how to diet. And, you know, it's, if you can't see yourself doing this long term, whatever the plan might be, you know, it's not going to last. You have to find things that don't eliminate total food groups, that where you can still socialize, where you can still go out to eat, where you can still, where people still want to hang out with you, you know? I used to say, that I lived 80-20, that, you know, 80% of the time I made positive, healthful choices, and I had 20% elbow room because I wanted elbow room. I just got back from a whirlwind trip to Rome.
I was going to ask you about that.
It was amazing, with my best friend who's a flight attendant, and just joined her on one of her trips. And that's all they eat there is pizza and pasta. I mean, truly. And so we had pasta or pizza every day. And, you know, I told her then, I said, thank God. I mean, we walked so much, but, you know, red wine, pasta, pizza, and all those things. Right. And you watched all the stuff that went in it. But you look at the Italians, and in Rome, I saw very, very few obese people. And probably the obese people I saw were probably American, you know. And yet that food is such an integral part
of their culture.
You know, so it just illustrated to me that, you know, you don't have to do some of these things. I'm a big advocate of plant-based. That doesn't mean animal-free. That just means eat mainly plants. And just balance across all the groups of food. And and of course, portion control is important, particularly on the items that are more energy dense.
Right.
You know, and go for it on some of the ones that are less energy dense. You know, those you can have more of. But I know I'm bouncing around a lot.
No, this is great. This is great. And, you know, for my audience, a lot of them, they do struggle with the pre-diabetes and diabetes, and we've kind of scratched the surface. But I did want to make mention of, in your book, The Nutrition for a Changing World, you have a spotlight section specifically on diabetes and nutrition. And I do recommend people get that book. You know, there's plenty of resources, but I really like this textbook because it, again, it's very practical with the illustrations and even understanding and breaking down complex terms, you know, understanding how the pancreas operates and the kidneys operate, the liver and all of that. So we can make more informed decisions when it comes to our food choices. And I like the 80-20 rule because, and what you said about not being highly restrictive in the diet, our eating pattern, if you will. So I definitely recommend people get the book and get some other resources that you have. I mean, Jamie has all kinds of content that she puts out on social media, and we want her to share, you know, her, how to find her on social media. But definitely to my folks who are dealing with type 2 diabetes, or you feel that you may be at risk of developing the condition, or you may be concerned about developing pre-diabetes, or you don't even know. Definitely you want to go out and get checked. You want to get your blood work done, get your glucose tolerance tests done, and become more educated, become more of an informed, health conscious person, so that you can live long and feel energetic, so you can fly to Rome too, like Jamie did, and, you know, eat as much pasta you want, you know. Anything else you want to share?
I would love, and I'm happy to make a free PDF of that spotlight available to your listeners. So I think I shared with you the PDF, and I'm happy for you to share that as a download for them. It just kind of covers some basic information. And if they're interested, I do post pretty regularly. I have a educational Facebook page called Jamie Pope Nutrition Prof, that I'd love people to check out. And, I try to post about, things that are kind of in the news, and usually provide a link to a media story with a little context that I write up before it. So to the things they're reading and hearing, to kind of give them some foundation and context for that.
I love it. I love it.
But can I come back so we can talk again?
Oh, anytime. I'm telling you, you're already a regular on the show. Come on. Definitely. I've been bragging about you, Jamie, to my friends. I even put a teaser out there that I was about to have you on the show. I mean, I just really appreciate you and just what you bring, what you've brought to the industry. You know what I mean? Because I believe you have a genuine heart. And I'm not trying to puff your head up, you know, but I mean, you're a rock star, and
you're kind. You know,
you've published books, and it's not just about publishing books just for the sake of publishing. I mean, anybody can publish a book, right? But you publish really good content that people can actually use at different stages of life. And I think that's really awesome. But yeah, definitely. There's a whole bunch of directions that we can go.
Yeah. Sounds great.
Yeah. What's the future hold for Miss Jamie Pope?
Still doing work with the textbook, looking towards the next update on that, which is always quite involved. And, you know, just had a meeting this morning. Textbooks are now are more and more grounded in digital content. Yeah. So looking at all the things we offer digitally, because so much is online now. And just I have two daughters that keep me busy, and going on a safari with friends this summer.
Wow.
So yeah, I kind of, since I stepped away from the classroom, I have a little more flexibility for travel and those things, which is kind of nice, because I've been at this a long time, but I'm going to stay at it. That's why I love my educational Facebook page. It keeps me engaged too. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a textbook is just an ongoing project. So,
yeah, I love it. I love it. And, you know, Jamie, I know you didn't provide any like meal plans or anything in the book, because it's more context, more text based for education and learning. But I definitely want people to keep up with you, because you do share some, you know, some ideas about, you know, here's some things that you may want to consider when you're choosing, let's say, a healthy dessert, you know, and so forth. I just really, really appreciate your work. I'm telling you, I'm going to keep raving about you.
So. Well, I love what you're doing. So this is great. You. And I almost came live to Atlanta, because if I didn't get on the flight with a buddy pass, I was in Atlanta and I was going to spend a couple of days with my daughter. And I thought, well, you know, I could call Oscar and see if he wants me to just come to the studio and do this.
Oh, so, definitely. And we could do something on location too, you know?
Yeah. She's at Georgia Tech. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Jamie, it has been a pleasure to have you on this week's episode of the Beating Diabetes Lifestyle Podcast.
Thank you.
And anything else you want to share? Closing
not,
out tomorrow?
Not that I can think of.
Okay.
We've touched on a lot today.
A lot. So, folks, there you have it. My really good friend now, my best. She's my best friend now, guys. So it is what it is. I'm already speaking. Oh, I do want to say this, and I'm going to put this out in the atmosphere. One day, Jamie is going to have her own podcast.
And you're going to help me. You're going to help me.
I'm going to help you. But anyway, thank you, Jamie.
Thank you.
Been a blessing. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you, Oscar.
All right. Thank you. There you have it, folks. I hope you really enjoyed this week's edition of the Beating Diabetes Lifestyle Podcast with my guest and friend, Jamie Pope. She will be joining me in the near future so we can even go deeper into the subject of nutrition and how we can all achieve optimal health. For now, and as always, stay focused, keep moving, never go back, leap forward, bounce back because you can, my friend. And above all else, remember, trust God. You got this. I believe in you. Be sure to visit the website at www.beatingdiabeteslifestyle.com for access to free resources and other information that will help you along your journey. If you would like to submit a question or a comment about the show, or to learn more about the Beating Diabetes Lifestyle, you can always email me at hello@beatingdiabeteslifestyle.com. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to this podcast.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Beating Diabetes Lifestyle Podcast with Oscar Camejo. We hope you enjoyed this episode. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for motivational and educational purposes only. It is not a substitute for professional care by a physician or other healthcare professional or qualified fitness instructor. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or professional advice or services. If you're looking for help on your journey, seek a qualified medical practitioner. It's important that you utilize someone who is a trained, licensed healthcare professional who can help you on your journey toward good health.